people to coordinate the final phase of the process, actually building the product with an external manufacturer. In addition to the application that tracked product components internally, we developed another tool for vendors to determine the release status of product components. Vendors, including the external manufacturer, also use this tool to download digital materials and electronically order non-digital materials. In this case, our digital tools not only enabled us to fix the process problem internally, but also enabled a company that specializes in manufacturing to take on new work for us. One question might be, why did we ever do manufacturing in the first place? Before we had digital processes, we had no choice. Today, our information tools are sophisticated enough to allow us to outsource manufacturing and still be confident that our products are being built to our specifications. We keep a core set of other professionals in-house and use the web as a primary way to coordinate with others outside. After 5 or 6 months, these teams not only fixed processes that had already caused problems, but they also found and dismantled a couple of other bad process time bombs that had not yet gone off. The new tools help identify potential conflicts in the process and let all of the players work together to resolve them before we have collisions or omissions. What is the value to a business of problems that never occur? Creating a process that stages your solution. The development history of an internal Microsoft application called HeadTracks is a good example of how the symbiosis between business needs and technology works to enable new processes that weren't possible in the pre-digital world. HeadTracks is a workflow application that handles the processing of personnel changes. A personnel change can mean an employee hire, a promotion, a transfer, or a change in department. Our efforts with HeadTracks show that sometimes it takes a series of iterative steps to understand the problem you're trying to solve and to get the process and technology right. Incomplete understanding of the objective is a major concern in every technology project, which is why you're usually better off tackling smaller processes and building on them. No matter how well you plan, you'll often find that you didn't understand everything you should have about the user's needs. If you spend 18 months delivering a complete solution and realize you haven't got it right, or that business needs have changed in that time, you'll be in pretty sad shape. A better approach is to use software tools that enable you to get something working in less than 6 months, and then improve the solution as you get user feedback. The first version of our personnel workflow application looked great until the electronic approval forms started landing in the email inboxes of our vice presidents. Some executives loved being able to handle most personnel changes online, but others didn't want to review every change, preferring to see just the approval forms for high-level hires or transfers. Executives in big divisions couldn't handle the volume. The old paper system made it easier to delegate, so we needed to add delegation to the digital system. The second version of the application had complete functionality, but the process flow still left something to be desired. At times, important approvals were sidetracked at lower levels, and minor changes still occasionally landed in the electronic lap of a VP. Working with Anderson Consulting, we realized we had 12 different approval processes in 15 major groups. Focusing on process, we reduced the 12 to 3, which are at the core of HeadTracks version 3.0. Today, managers originate all employee transactions online. Any reviewer can push back a request to have the original requester change the request and resend it digitally, or the reviewer can approve the transaction with changes so that it continues on its path. All of the people involved with the request will get email with a link to the change request so that they can review it. Historically, most human resources rejections of personnel change requests have come from minor questions or miscoding problems. HeadTracks virtually does away with those kind of rejections. A work on behalf feature, which enables a manager to delegate approval responsibilities for any class of personnel requests to other people, has turned out to be the most important HeadTracks function. A vice president might authorize an administrative assistant to approve routine position or personnel changes, and authorize senior managers to approve compensation or promotion requests for their teams. Work on behalf gives executives a way to create time-saving exceptions and still keep the approval process moving. If a 1,000-person division changes cost centers, or if entire teams are shuffled during a reorganization, an administrative assistant can highlight the groups en masse and make all the changes in the organizational chart with the click of a single button. A routing feature adds more flexibility. The requesting manager can add someone to the review loop before the request goes to human resources. For example, if a senior manager wants to review a particular type of employee transaction, such as promotions. HeadTrax is useful for non-administrative work, too. Starting with whatever employee's name you enter, HeadTrax displays the entire organizational hierarchy, up and down, for all staff. HeadTrax also enables you to create organizational charts on the fly and customize views of the charts according to a variety of properties, such as full name, phone number, office number, department number, and so on. Now that it's done, HeadTrax seems like an obvious solution, an application that any medium-size or large company can use. It's more than just a way to eliminate personnel-related paperwork from the desks of executives. It's an engine that drives personnel changes into our accounting and budget systems whenever there's an organizational change. It ensures that all of our business systems stay in sync. Because the HeadTrax system is new, it's difficult to come up with exact figures for the savings in time and energy it's given us in eliminating missing or incomplete paperwork and hours of data entry. But by late 1998, HeadTrax was processing approximately 8,000 transactions per month. Approvals that no longer require human resources review, which constitute 90% of all personnel requests, are reflected in the system within 24 hours. Human resources approvals take longer because of processes that aren't tied to technology. For instance, an exit interview for someone leaving the company. HeadTrax improves accountability by enabling business or human resources managers to review at any time the status of all outstanding personnel changes. By viewing the headcount status in his group, a business manager can track how people are doing in filling job vacancies. If the manager discovers that one of his direct reports has far more open headcount than other managers in the department, the senior manager can look into whether the hiring manager needs to spend more time on recruiting or needs more help from our recruiting group. Human resources managers recognized that it was not the best use of their time to add their okay to every routine personnel change. Instead, they developed an electronic tool for routine actions and for data collection for trend analysis on personnel issues. A senior human resources manager might make use of the audit capabilities of HeadTrax, reviewing all rejected changes to see whether a pattern revealed a need for more education of managers on personnel issues, or a need for additional functionality in the HeadTrax application. Or, human resources might analyze whether one operating unit has higher turnover than others, and whether there is a pattern in the reasons for people leaving the organization. HeadTrax not only streamlines the process for our business people, it also enables our human resources staff to redefine their roles. The ability to immediately see statistics about things such as transfer rates or turnover is worth far more than the lower costs or savings in time. Identifying the primary, focused objective of any process is the way to begin solving process problems. Whether for production processes or internal business processes, the goal should always be a fundamental kind of simplification, having the least number of people engaged in the least number of handoffs. It's extremely difficult to optimize a paper process. Digital technology makes it possible to develop much better processes, instead of being stuck with variations on the old paper processes that give you only incremental improvements. Real process breakthroughs come through the combination of well-thought-out solutions with digital information flow. Using digital processes to solve tough problems. One of the thorniest business processes at Microsoft is the hiring, management, and payment of contingent staff. For a company with a lot of projects where work peaks around product releases, the proper management of contingent staff is vital. Temp workers help us handle peak loads in everything from development and testing to marketing to administrative support. Five different groups need to be coordinated in our use of temporary workers. 1, the temps themselves. 2, the 110 agencies for which the temps work. 3, the managers using temp workers in various divisions. 4, our internal contingent staffing group, which manages our relationships with the temp agencies and tracks the hourly rates for temp workers. And 5, corporate procurement, which actually pays the bills. Our business problem was multifaceted. It wasn't just that a lot of paperwork was involved with contracting for services from many different agencies and temps. We also had difficulty ensuring a consistent contracting process, obtaining the correct people at the proper hourly rate, not using them for too many consecutive projects or for too long a time on any one project, and deciding when to convert people to full-time. A hiring policy developed several years ago established stringent guidelines on the use of temp workers. By policy, all temps had to be hired through agencies, and no contingent staff could work for more than 340 days on any combination of projects without having at least a 31-day break in service. But a paper process makes it hard to ensure that the managers contracting for temps, many of whom were new to the company or new to the role, follow the guidelines. Given the predisposition of our hiring managers to act when things need to be done, the only way we could meet the needs of the departments and to prevent mistakes was by throwing a lot of bodies at the problem. People-intensive processes did not make any of us happy. Further, the paper process did not solve the budgeting problem for senior managers. Because many managers hired temps, and because temps often worked on multiple projects, senior managers in the divisions could not get a handle on the total number of contingent staff being used, or on the number of hours they were putting in. We could not, with any consistency, predict costs for temp staffing. The accounting data on the number of workers, hours, and costs that division managers were getting from finance would be consistently late, or would be only estimates instead of actual hours and costs. Payments showed huge spikes and dips month to month. At first, we thought the problem was in the finance department's process, but as we analyzed the data, we realized that finance was getting poor information, too. Our payment process had very few controls. Despite a lot of sign-offs, managers signed time cards for temps who submitted them to their agencies, who sent us invoices on which procurement paid, there were actually no financial controls. A manager couldn't verify the hourly rate or the number of hours invoiced. An invoice could be submitted without a signed time card. A manager might agree to a raise for a temp, but contingent staffing might not get the information. Or a temp might get a raise on one project and have the raise applied incorrectly to other projects. We had no way to stop duplicate billings. Stepping back, the business teams looked at the entire process from beginning to end to determine how digital information could help us manage the complexity. One management issue was whether the manager had the authority to hire contingent staff to begin with. In our paper system, there was no way to ensure management review of the initial decision to get more resources. Once the decision was made to get a temp worker, managers didn't have enough information to know whether they were following the related business rules. For example, did the manager have budget for the work? Was the manager willing to authorize overtime for the project? In addition, the hiring manager had no way of easily knowing the appropriate hourly rate for a particular job or what qualified people might be available. Unless the hiring manager already had a specific person in mind, we had no easy way to identify a potential resource, whether a company, an agency temp, or an independent contractor. We needed a way to automatically calculate the full cost of the assignment up front for proper budgeting. We decided we needed a new, flexible software solution. For each temp, we had to ensure a contract was written and signed up front. Once the contract was approved, the person's card key, phone, and network access had to be available within 48 hours. Users had to be able to easily create multiple identical requests for similar positions, a typical situation when you're gearing up for a big project. While the contractor was working, managers needed a simple way to verify the hours worked, the rate being paid, and the amount of money remaining on the purchase order. As the date for termination approached, the hiring manager needed to be alerted automatically. The manager needed to be able to automatically extend the person, but only if there was budget remaining and the temp had worked less than 340 consecutive days for Microsoft. When the termination date arrived, the person's access to the network, email, phone, and buildings had to be turned off. Our new process had to support changes without holding up the work. If the approval manager was not available when a contract was ready, the hiring manager had to be able to reroute the approval to another person with signing authority. If the manager or cost center changed during the assignment, we had to be able to easily reallocate the cost. The agency should be able to give temps a small pay raise at its discretion, but should get the hiring manager's approval for a large raise. Deciding whether to centralize. One approach would be to create a huge monolithic application to handle all of these requirements, the one big app approach. We did this once with an application intended to enable a dozen of our internal service organizations, the library, security, catering, travel, the company store, the corporate credit card group, and others, to track and respond to employee requests. Ultimately, this project became one of the few we've scrapped. The needs of the various groups were different enough that the business rules were too complex for one application to handle. We spent so much time getting the system to work that by the time we finished, the requirements had changed. We learned an important lesson. very few corporate applications need a central point of view. We set each group free to build its own request system. By downsizing the scale of the solution, we squeezed out a lot of complexity and development time. Today, all the internal service groups have their own request applications, which they improve every few months. They are all great examples of paperless processes that save time and make it easier to track the delivery of great service. We avoid long development cycles for internal applications. Too much time often nullifies any benefits, and business needs change along the way. Smaller, decentralized processes are usually best. Only a few applications, such as our financial reporting system, require centralization. As we have undertaken other business solutions internally, we have kept teams and projects small, keeping in mind the motto of our product development teams, "Shipping is a feature." In looking at managing contingent staff, we wanted to avoid a monolithic approach, but at the same time not end up with half a dozen discrete applications that wouldn't snap together to create an overall business solution. Our strategy, then, was to create a series of modular applications that were designed from the start with the idea of interlinking their digital data. The primary tools are MS Market, the corporate procurement application on our intranet, MS Invoice, a private website on the internet, or extranet, which enables our contracting agencies and others to submit invoices electronically, and our SAP system, which handles all of the back-end financial transactions. Since we already had HeadTrax for managing personnel, we used HeadTrax as the user interface, regardless of which of the applications actually owned the code behind the scenes. The user would simply click on a certain feature in HeadTrax, and the correct application would be triggered. The contracting process begins with digital procurement in MS Market, which I describe fully in Chapter 3. The steps in creating, hiring, and managing contingent staff are very similar to the electronic controls that HeadTrax already provides for managing regular staff. MS Invoice provides for electronic submission of invoices and for controls to help both the hiring manager and the vendors stay within budget. With each invoice, the hiring manager has a link to see the amount remaining on the purchase order. Vendors can see which of their billings match up against what invoices. If a vendor attempts to submit an invoice that is more than the amount remaining on the purchase order, the submission is rejected. If the vendor gives a temp employee a raise, the Microsoft manager can approve or deny it with the click of a button. Astute readers might wonder why we're using invoices at all, electronic or otherwise. After all, leaders in the manufacturing industry have been able to eliminate invoices entirely. A classic example is Ford's elimination of invoices for its inventory ordering. When receiving accepts a parts delivery, the person enters the receipt of the materials electronically, triggering an automatic payment to the vendor. The manufacturer has the parts, the supplier has payment. Who needs an invoice, even a digital invoice? We have experimented with a similar approach, but uncovered a number of differences where services are involved rather than physical goods. In manufacturing, every item has a part number. It's more difficult to create a one-to-one relationship with time from a temp worker when what you're receiving are hours of time spent on a project. It's difficult for the vendor to relate back an electronic payment to the particular worker and particular week without a separate reference, the invoice number. We have yet to see an invoiceless payment system for services that works for our vendors. The big issue for us was making the temp process fully digital so that all the information was easily available. A rule of thumb is that a lousy process will consume 10 times as many hours as the work itself requires. Many examples in the literature describe how re-engineering reduced 30-day processes to 3, or 10 days to 1. A good process will eliminate the wasted time, and technology will speed up the remaining real work. Our new contingent staffing application will speed the process, but that improvement won't be the most important benefit. Improving management oversight for the contracting process and ensuring that everyone follows the hiring guidelines and budget are big business benefits. Even more important is that we can relate performance from job to job and maintain a better relationship with these workers. Improving step by step. Be prepared to experiment with new processes and technology solutions. Nobody can predict every possible wrinkle or problem with a new process or application. People have to use it before they and the developers can determine what really works and what doesn't. And users invariably see new ways to extend an application once they get their hands on it. Once we saw how HeadTrax worked for full-time personnel, we realized we could handle contingent personnel. Once we saw how great HeadTrax was for personnel transactions, we realized we could add the ability to track historical information in order to compare headcount changes year to year for budgeting purposes. That feature will be part of the next release. Complexity is the death of all re-engineering projects, especially those that involve technology. According to an article in the Wall Street Journal, a 1996 survey of 360 companies by the research firm Standish Group International found that 42% of corporate information technology projects were abandoned before completion. Complexity was the usual culprit, according to the article, which called the waste staggering, and added that the bigger the projects are, the more frequently and expensively they tend to fail. Projects of only 3 to 4 months' duration are going to have much lower failure rates. With short projects, you're forced to make important trade-offs that will drive you to simplicity and focus. You'll end up with goals that can be executed. If short projects fail, and a few do for a variety of reasons, your loss in time and money is much smaller. It's far easier psychologically to pull out and redirect your development team because people haven't spent a year of their lives working on a project that's now going down the tubes. Even projects that cumulatively take several years can be staged as a series of smaller projects with definable checkpoints. Such an approach enables the projects to proceed in parallel and gives you the benefit of a faster digital process in many areas, even if you get hung up in one or two. Dayton Hudson, the fifth largest retail chain in the United States, wanted to reduce the merchandising cycle time for its 1,100 department stores, the time it takes to order an item and get it on a store shelf. The company broke each business process into discrete steps: design, color and fabric selection, vendor selection, and so on, and then implemented each one quickly and independently. The resulting digital processes were linked together, reducing its cycle time for domestic items from 25 days to less than 10 for its stores: Dayton's, Hudson's, Target, Mervyn's, and Marshall Field's. Projects undertaken once your digital environment is established will have more success. If your environment is mostly paper, a new digital application will be outside of the normal business activities, and the normal learning curve for the application could make it seem like a lot of trouble for its worth. If the environment is digital, though, you'll be able to propagate the application quickly. You can leverage training over many applications. Workers who become very adept at using technology also become very demanding when it comes to how well new applications need to work. Once you have a few successful applications working for you, people say, "Hey, why isn't our headcount system like our sales system? Why can't we move from summary data to detail here? Do you realize it would be easy to put in electronic alerts for people there?" They'll point you to other applications or web pages that you could easily connect to, and you'll end up with a more complete solution. Taking advantage of your existing technical investments, you can create new digital applications for only marginal costs, creating a huge return. You already need email for ad hoc communications. You need access to the World Wide Web to get information about the world at large. You need external websites to promote yourself to customers and partners. And you need internal websites for corporate information. Why not use these technologies for every business process? Take advantage of both technology and your existing employee know-how. Owning process change. At our second CEO Summit in 1998, we put together a panel made up of CEOs and CIOs talking about the intersection of business needs and technology. One question to the panelists was, what caused big technology failures? Ralph Larson, CEO of Johnson & Johnson, said that the most frequent cause of spectacular failures is that business people simply turn over big projects to their IT departments or outside consultants and then run because it's such hard work. Ralph said, "You absolutely cannot do that. All the successes you see come because of strong business line ownership, not IT ownership. Business line ownership with strong IT support. The project doesn't belong to the consultants or to IT. It doesn't belong to anyone else but the business owner." It's impossible to properly re-engineer a process using technology without the oversight of someone who can bridge the business and technical teams. This business process owner doesn't have to be the most senior or the most technical person on the business side of your organization, but the person does have to understand the business need and how the technology will be used in actual work. The person must be respected enough in the organization to make decisions stick. That's the person most likely to have insight into developing newer, simpler processes and negotiating trade-offs between business and technical requirements. Ralph's response got strong support from the CIOs on the panel. Alcoa's CIO, Patricia Higgins, said that the only time she had seen major cost overruns on a re-engineering project had been when the business side hadn't been in charge. Never use new information technology simply to replace old business processes or even legacy IT systems, she said. Always take the opportunity to review and streamline the process, asking yourself what your business priorities are. The costs come, many companies discover, when you don't redo your processes as part of the new solutions. Invariably, you have to bring in someone else later to re-engineer the solutions to make them work. Who should own the re-engineering process? Whichever business leader is in the greatest pain today, or stands to benefit the most tomorrow, should own the development of the new process and the technology that supports it. Business lessons. Attack process problems from a variety of perspectives, and use technology to create streamlined processes that were never possible before. Reevaluate all processes periodically. Redesign processes to deliver optimal information flow, and you'll solve your important business problems. Process problems boil down to simplification, having the least number of employees engaged in the least number of handoffs. Business leaders, not IT alone, must own decisions about processes involving technology. A lousy process will consume 10 times as many hours as the work itself requires. A good process will eliminate the wasted time. Technology will speed up the remaining real work. Complexity is the death of all re-engineering projects, especially those that involve technology. Diagnosing your digital nervous system. Do your digital systems enable quick deployment of an initial solution and other improvements staged in over time? Do they make it easy for every employee to track status? Do they make it easy to see trends that call for management action? Can you build a large process from several independent smaller processes and link these to create an efficient system? Are you using digital information flow to simplify an entire process from beginning to end? Do you avoid long development cycles by creating smaller, modular solutions that are designed from the start to exchange digital data? Chapter 18. Treat it as a strategic resource. Information technology so far has been a producer of data rather than a producer of information, let alone a producer of new and different questions and new and different strategies. Top executives have not used the new technology because it has not provided the information they need for their own tasks. Peter Drucker. Because the handling of information is core to business, CEOs should become as engaged in IT as in any other important business function. Too many CEOs, though, have remained distant from IT. Information systems are often thought of as too complex and unmanageable. Making IT relevant to business strategy seemed like an intractable problem. Discussions always seemed to get bogged down in acronyms. However the CIO tried to say it, the real message was that the old systems were too complex, too expensive, and too inflexible to meet new or changing needs. With the technology changes of the last couple of years, the CEO now has the opportunity to redirect the company's technology. But this redirection requires 3 things of a CEO. First, the CEO must be sure to regard information technology as a strategic resource to help the business get more out of its people. IT should not be regarded as just a cost center. Second, the CEO needs to learn enough about technology to be able to ask good, hard questions of the CIO and to be able to tell whether good answers are coming back. IT is no different from sales or finance or manufacturing in this respect. Third, the CEO needs to bring the CIO into management's deliberations and strategizing. It's impossible to align IT strategy with business strategy if the CIO is out of the business loop. The knowledge of CEOs about technology varies widely, from Paul O'Neill, CEO of Alcoa, who began his career writing computer software for the Veterans Administration, to many others like Ralph Larson, the CEO of Johnson & Johnson, who have no background in technology at all. Paul's technical experience meant that he wasn't intimidated by technology. He knew from the start that a company's information systems had to be treated holistically. Ralph's inexperience made him determined to learn. He worked on his own on weekends for 2 years, teaching himself to use a number of PC applications. He knew that without a better understanding of technology, he wouldn't have the credibility he'd need to convince Johnson & Johnson's 180 operating companies in 55 different countries to standardize their information systems. At that time, in the late 1980s, Ralph and the other executives at Johnson & Johnson were drowning in paper. Not information, paper. If Ralph needed information, he would have to get the finance group to prepare a special report. Ralph and Johnson & Johnson went through a painful process of trying to make sure everybody understood that a common set of systems was absolutely essential to our competitive survival. When the new systems were finally coming online, Ralph ran into an executive and asked him, "Did you get my note?" The executive said no. Ralph said, "I sent you an email." The executive said, "Well, I don't use a computer." Ralph said, "Then you'll never hear from me again, because that's the only way I'm going to communicate to senior management in written form." Next day, the executive had a computer on his desk. John Warner, chief administrative officer at Boeing, used a leading from the top strategy too. The first four people to go up on Boeing's new email system were, in order, the CEO, the two operating presidents, and John himself. John knew that if the senior executives were on one email system, everybody else in the company would want to be on that system too. Boeing thought it would take several years for email to become strategic, but the company learned otherwise only a few months after the system was installed. While a senior executive in Seattle was trying to coordinate with a sales team in Europe to close a big order in 1996, maintenance workers accidentally cut the power to the mail server. Because the machine went down during America's Thanksgiving holiday, it took several days to get it back online. Boeing got the order, but from then on the company put in place the same backup and support capabilities for its email system that it had for its other major business systems. The point of these examples is that the CEO must recognize the strategic importance of technology as he or she does with other important business initiatives and lead the way. You don't have to be a technology expert. In fact, if you know too many technology-related acronyms, you're focusing on the wrong aspect of technology. To know how technology can help your business, you need to start with just a baseline understanding of computers. It doesn't matter how you get it. I know some executives who have had consultants come in every week and teach them the things they need to know about technology. Another way to learn is to have a good relationship with your CIO. Getting CIOs to think of business. When Patricia Higgins was asked to become CIO of Alcoa, and when Joanne Heisen was asked to become CIO of Johnson & Johnson, both women had the same initial reaction, to decline. They both saw IT as a back-office support organization that wasn't integrated into the business. Patricia had been in a variety of business roles at communications companies. Her last job had been president of the communications sector at Unisys. Joanne had been treasurer and corporate controller of Johnson & Johnson for several years. Her only interaction with the technology group had been challenging the business value of its spending requests. Joanne asked Ralph, "What have you done to me here? Does CIO stand for career is over?" But both women became convinced that their CEOs wanted to bring a business eye to the CIO job and to redefine its role. This approach of having business people take the CIO job is a growing trend. Patricia became an advisor and coach to the business units on how they could use information as a strategic asset to continue to grow their revenues and profits. Joanne was the business person with good personal skills, whom Ralph wanted to bridge the total disconnect between the business and IT groups at Johnson & Johnson. Business managers were frustrated with the level of service, and our technical people felt abused and disrespected, Ralph says. I needed someone who could talk to both. At first, Joanne thought it was incumbent on her to learn techno-speak. Then she realized that IT people needed to be able to speak the language of business. That insight was the beginning of sessions in which Joanne would describe the company's business problems and insist that the technical staff describe in simple non-jargon how technology could help. Joanne, sometimes described as the walking annual report at Johnson & Johnson, made sure that IT people understood the business issues, the business goals, the changing business issues in healthcare, and the products moving along Johnson & Johnson's pipeline. Then she challenged the IT teams, how could they support current efforts, and how could they support future revenue growth? This dialogue was the first major step in redefining the role of IT at Johnson & Johnson. Because CIOs have not always had the best access to CEOs, some CIOs today insist that they report directly to the CEO. That isn't necessarily critical, But however you organize your senior management, the important thing is to have a close working relationship between the most senior technology person and the senior business staff, and the CEO needs to be engaged in their discussions. At Alcoa and Johnson & Johnson, the CIO sits on the highest level management committee, and CIOs of the operating companies sit on their company's management boards. Carlson Companies, an international leader in hospitality, travel, and marketing services, has the CIO on the Strategic Planning, Executive, and Capital Appropriations Committees. Carlson regularly convenes an IT council in which the head of business planning meets with the chief technology officers from the various divisions. The company has two formal meetings a year in which the CEO and other senior executives explain business strategy and what it means for IT to all of the 750 IT employees at its headquarters. Senior technology people gather twice a year to trade best practices supporting business goals. If your CIO reports to the chief financial officer, though, I'd suggest you take another look at your organization. If IT reports to the CFO, IT is likely to be viewed as an overhead item, and the focus is likely to be on cutting costs. IT needs to be viewed in terms of the business opportunities it helps create, and should report through the business side. If you've got a business-savvy CFO, the CIO's reporting to the CFO might work. If you don't, you may want to try some other arrangement. At Microsoft, the CIO and the CFO both report to Bob Herbold, our chief operating officer, who brings us many years of experience in both business and information services. Since the founding of Microsoft, I've always applied technology before applying labor to try to solve business problems. Integration of our IT world with our business objectives begins with the business, marketing, and sales plans of the senior executives, Steve Ballmer, Bob Herbold, Jeff Rakes, and others. After reviewing their plans, John Connors, the Microsoft CIO, creates an initial IT plan. John further develops his plan through a series of meetings with Bob, the VPs of all the lines of business, and John's IT heads. This plan, which now contains all the technology initiatives and financial costs, goes to Steve for review, and a consensus plan then comes to me. For IT, as well as all our business units, these annual plans are updated at mid-year. In addition, John meets with the executive committee four other times a year on topical issues. Topics in fiscal year 98 were the planned merger of the technical systems for all our internet properties, the long-term strategy for our physical networking infrastructure, progress on the availability and reliability of our major system products, and the strengths and weaknesses of our core system products in large-scale enterprise environments. John's recommendations on how we improve our enterprise products come from another complication of his job. He has to use our software before anybody outside Microsoft does. John is charged with using our large IT environment as a real-world lab. We call this approach eating your own dog food. It's an inelegant but affectionate name for serious work. If we can't run our own business on our technologies, we're not going to try to make customers do it. Before releasing our Microsoft Exchange email product, for example, one requirement was that it had to be in use as our own internal email system, serving our then 14,000 employees. This requirement to use betas for business, and the makeup of our senior staff, a bunch of whom know more about technology than John does, gives our CIO unique challenges. He probably gets more resources than most CIOs do, but he has more people looking over his shoulder, too. The expectations for his job are very high. Of course, no CIO has it easy. The IT job is one where you get an F if you fail, but only a C if you succeed. This stuff is supposed to work, right? One time after a particularly difficult IT review, John went home and expressed his frustration to his wife. "She told me my job was like helping design car parts for Henry Ford," John says. "The feedback I give our product people will go to improve life for customers all over the world. She reminded me that I really do have a fun job, and I signed up for it voluntarily." As we shifted our business strategies to include the internet in the last several years, John has shifted our IT resources to match. His overall priorities have been to develop the applications needed for us to use the internet as a communications vehicle for partners and customers, and to build out our bandwidth to handle the huge ramp-up in networking traffic from customers, partners, and our employees worldwide. We've had few real disconnects between business and IT over the years. The ones that occur usually result from new initiatives within a division by people who do not understand the IT requirements behind their programs. They may announce a public date before they get IT's buy-off. With one online licensing program, the missed signals forced us to use a less-than-perfect, kludgy, technical solution that IT had to hold together while properly designing the system for the next release. Sometimes, customer and market pressure create the same dilemma. A service called Windows Update, which enables users to easily obtain upgrades and software fixes from the web, had to be available 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, or 7x24 availability, with a very short time to prepare. Fortunately, John's team had done enough 7x24 projects for our other internet sites by 1998, when the new service began, that he had the expertise in place to do the back-end work in time. A good IT staff can handle the occasional unexpected project, but the CEO has to exercise leadership to ensure that IT is not overwhelmed. The CEO has to make sure that all senior executives agree on the top 5 to 8 IT priorities each year and understand the trade-offs on other projects in order to carry out the top ones. The more savvy the CEO is about IT capabilities, the more the CEO can help make the right trade-offs when other urgent projects pop up. Without the CEO enforcing priorities, the CIO and IT staff will try to do too many things. They'll end up doing them all marginally. Placing the responsibility where it belongs. The initial cost of any computer infrastructure is high. IT is and will remain a large part of the corporate cost structure. In 30 years, IT will have grown from 5% of total business equipment spending to more than 50% by the year 2000. In some industries, such as insurance and security brokerages, IT constitutes more than 80% of the cost of all equipment used. A company has to make the most use of this investment in order to succeed. Often the CIO is expected to justify the cost of the infrastructure, but this responsibility is misplaced. Because the infrastructure benefits all of the company's business functions, the CEO is ultimately the person responsible for decisions on IT spending. The CIO is responsible for advising the CEO, implementing the infrastructure once the decision is made, and building the business applications on top of it. The CIO must also drive the understanding, learning, and thinking about the business down into the ranks of the technical staff and organize them to support business needs. But the business knowledge can be transferred to the IT staff only if the CIO is privy to it. If IT doesn't get business issues and the CEO does not integrate the CIO into important business decisions, then the fault is the CEO's. If IT doesn't get business issues, but the CEO does include the CIO in business strategy, then the fault is the CIO's. Perhaps this situation is why the CIO job is sometimes described as the end of a career and sometimes described as a stepping stone to the CEO position. Someone who can see how to put technology at the service of business needs is of great value to a company. Someone who can't is not helping the company very much. A requirement is establishing a modern digital infrastructure. Sometimes a CEO has to stand up to division or subsidiary presidents, all of whom are used to making technology decisions independently, and all of whom will always say their needs are different. The major consulting companies can offer advice in this area. One methodology, incorporated into an application called IT Advisor, helps management assess its IT situation so that it can either avoid or get out of the IT abyss. A company that's fallen into the IT abyss is seeing rapid IT spending increases, disproportionately high maintenance costs, exploding complexity, and little return on new development. Based on research by McKinsey and Company, IT Advisor helps companies evaluate current IT assets, IT management processes, and IT business performance based on 69 evaluation criteria. You can see where your company is in regard to IT effectiveness and get a good idea of where to focus your energies, if you have to climb out of the abyss. The goal is to reach the IT mountaintop, where you have a robust and flexible infrastructure, IT spending and organization directed at business solutions, and several best-in-class business applications. If you want to get a quick sense of where your company is today, take a look at the interactive IT advisor on the website for this book, www.speedofthought.com. Another way to assess your infrastructure is to look at the percentage of IT resources you're spending on buying and managing computers, providing help desk support, and running backroom IT applications. If more than a third of your IT resources go into these routine jobs, your IT operations are inefficient, probably because your infrastructure is overly complex. While trying to figure out how to improve citizen services, the state of South Australia did a study that showed it was spending 55% of its IT effort on administration. By comparison, companies with efficient IT organizations spent only 30% on the routine stuff. The state figured that a more efficient infrastructure could effectively free up 25% more IT resources that could be spent on creating solutions for better citizen services. It moved to a PC infrastructure, standardized its messaging platform, and outsourced maintenance on a fixed bid basis to ensure that costs were controlled. Carlson went a similar route in outsourcing the maintenance of its legacy applications. Like South Australia, Carlson wanted to free internal developers to create business solutions. Every situation is a bit different, though. A study by Johnson & Johnson showed that Johnson & Johnson was already more efficient in mainframe maintenance than an outside firm would be. Johnson & Johnson saw no reason to outsource maintenance. As these examples show, outsourcing works well when the outside vendor brings a set of best practices that are outside of your company's expertise or outside of your primary development focus. I do not, however, recommend outsourcing the development of strategic applications. I talked to one company that was thinking about outsourcing their entire IT effort, and I asked them what would be left of their business. What would that company do if the vendor did a poor job or just walked away from the project one day? You should measure IT costs carefully, of course, but ultimately you should judge your infrastructure in terms of the business value it gives you. If you're going to spend the money anyway, wouldn't you rather spend it on solutions than on simply keeping the engine running? A good infrastructure will cut baseline costs, but a CEO should always be asking what the infrastructure enables rather than what costs it reduces. It's a matter of emphasis. Each year, the company should strive to spend a smaller percentage of resources on routine functions and a greater percentage on new business solutions. When you review project costs, be particularly careful to avoid the trap of assigning the underlying cost of infrastructure improvement to the first application that will take advantage of it. This approach could make a valuable business solution appear to be financially infeasible. Instead, ask how much the second and third business applications will cost. Additional solutions should come in at relatively low incremental costs. A good messaging system, for instance, is expensive, but additional workflow applications built on that messaging system should be relatively cheap. Training should be included in infrastructure costs, too. Often companies invest huge amounts of money in hardware and software and neglect to fund the training of the people who use it. What's the point? Every successful application of technology involves generous and ongoing doses of training. Build training into the annual budgets. It'll be the best investment you'll ever make. It's not a coincidence that most of the companies I've described in this book have taken the approach of driving IT to undertake specific projects that help increase revenue through improved products, reduced product costs, faster delivery, and improved customer service. These companies have learned a valuable lesson. The purpose of IT is to make money. Rather than focus on keeping IT costs down, evaluate cost in terms of effectiveness for the bottom line. The secret to business success in the digital age is IT success. The secret to IT success is a modern, flexible infrastructure based on PC and internet standards. Business lessons. The CEO must understand IT as well as he or she understands any other business function. The responsibility for strategic use of IT can't be delegated to the CIO. The CEO must regard information technology as a strategic resource to help the company generate revenue. The CIO has to be an integral part of the development of business strategy and must be able to articulate in plain language what IT can do to help execute that strategy. Treat training costs as part of your basic infrastructure costs. Diagnosing your digital nervous system. Each year, do you spend a smaller percentage of resources on keeping systems running and a greater percentage on new business solutions? Do you have several best-in-class business applications? How expensive is it to add new solutions to your current infrastructure? Part 5. Special Enterprises Provide General Lessons. Chapter 19. No Healthcare System is an Island. Bedside manners are no substitute for the right diagnosis. Alfred Sloan, GM Chairman. A few years ago, a new Microsoft employee was called back to his home state because his mother had suffered a mild stroke. When she was well enough to leave the hospital, Mrs. Jones, not her real name, stayed with her sister while her son completed arrangements to move her out to the Northwest to be near him. Mrs. Jones largely recovered, but was never able to live on her own again, and her periods of good health were punctuated by hospital stays, treating more and more acute problems. The medical events of the last 2 years of Mrs. Jones's life demonstrate the best and the worst aspects of American health care. She received good care, including a number of state-of-the-art procedures, from 3 different hospitals and more than 12 physicians in 2 different states. As her physical abilities declined, her middle-class family was able to find decent facilities, providing greater degrees of care. Medicare and her private insurance paid most of the bills. She and her family picked up the rest. Her many doctors, nurses, and other caregivers were professional and uniformly kind. Mrs. Jones retained her dignity to the end, when she died in her sleep. Yet the system was far from perfect. When Mrs. Jones left the first hospital for her sister's hometown, 30 miles away, a lapse of communication between doctors led to her medication being kept at full strength when Mrs. Jones should have been on a declining dosage. By the time she arrived in the Northwest, side effects of the high dosage required her to be hospitalized immediately. Because her records didn't come with her, a number of expensive tests had to be redone. The same thing happened when she changed hospitals a year later. Her final 3-week hospital stay, which did not involve any surgical procedures, nevertheless cost $25,000. At one point, her outgoing doctor confused her with another patient and told the next doctor over the phone that her recent hospital stays were an abuse of the system. This was less than a week before Mrs. Jones died. These and other problems went on, even though Mrs. Jones had family advocates to work through the maze of medical and social services options. Her son and daughter-in-law took turns, spending many hours standing in line at one agency or on the phone with another, and it took a year before they could convince one hospital to stop billing them for services that had been paid in full. Because of the many hospitals, physicians, clinics, pharmacies, care facilities, and public and private agencies involved, the amount of paperwork was unbelievable. During periods of Mom's acute care, paper piled up at a rate of exactly 1 inch per month, her son said. On business trips, he took to carrying an extra binder containing the current paperwork related to his mom's care. When he was caught up with his own work, he would painstakingly reconcile bills using colored post-it notes, blue if a bill had been submitted to Medicare, yellow if it had gone through Medicare and been submitted to a private insurance company, red if he'd returned the bill because of errors, and green if the bill had gone all the way through the system and he was ready to write a check for the balance. Consider the number of people this paperwork represented. For every doctor and nurse who treated his mom, there must have been 12 billing people in a bunch of different organizations: the hospital or doctor's office, the pharmacy, the social agency, Medicare, the insurance company. It was like an old-fashioned military campaign. For every soldier in the field, you had 20 people behind the lines, handling logistics. Most experts estimate that 20% to 30% of the annual trillion-dollar cost of the U.S. healthcare system is tied up in paperwork. In hospitals, that number could be as high as 40% to 50%. A single week's stay can generate as many as 100 pieces of paper. Compounding the cost, about 13% of the 1 to 2 billion claims filed each year in the United States are returned for errors. Paperwork and complexity have soared, even as the U.S. healthcare industry has shifted to managed care in an effort to reduce costs, prevent fraud, and ensure consistent and appropriate care. Under the managed care model, an organization, whether Medicare or a private insurance company, will contract with a group of doctors to provide medical services toward managed outcomes and for fixed fees: $1,000 for an appendectomy, $15 for a flu shot, and so on. According to the 1998 sourcebook of health insurance data, more than 160 million people in the United States were enrolled in a managed care plan at the beginning of 1997, the last year for which figures were available. Doctors appreciate the need to control costs, but feel buried in regulations and second-guessed by layers of bureaucrats. They're afraid that their medical options are being limited and that patient care may suffer. They have also complicated matters themselves, treating patient files as business records and often hesitating to share them with competing physicians. And they've been largely computer-averse, although much of that aversion can be attributed to the clunkiness and expense of early medical systems. Curiously enough, the managed care that many physicians love to hate may turn out to be the primary driver that extends information systems into patient care and returns control of patient care to doctors. When you get enough clinically helpful information in front of physicians, they see the benefits and ask for more. Patients, meanwhile, are recognizing how much more information is available to them on the web, and how this information gives them a sense of control and responsibility in the maintenance of their own health. Clinical benefits have also encouraged healthcare CEOs to push for better information systems, sometimes against resistance by their boards of directors, which have too often focused on the cost-cutting during the mergers of the last several years. Up to now, healthcare has applied only 2-3% of its revenues to information technology, compared with, say, the banking industry's 15%. Although healthcare is a high-tech field, the technology has been directed at standalone diagnostic systems, not at information flow. Often the information applications that are used aren't designed to work with other information applications, despite all the healthcare areas that should share data: the lab, the pharmacy, radiology, the blood bank, medical monitoring devices, charting, and billing systems. Organizations have had to build special interfaces between each and every application. A typical healthcare organization can have hundreds of these interfaces. One organization currently manages 1,800 different interfaces. This complexity is one reason it typically has taken 2 years for a healthcare organization to buy a new system and another 2 years to install it. Too slow by any standard. Today, the situation is more encouraging. The U.S. government has passed legislation requiring the definition of a standard for electronic finance and administrative transactions, including computer-based patient records. Several organizations are working to establish nationwide technical standards for interoperability of medical applications. The Microsoft Healthcare Users Group, which with MS HUG has one of the friendliest acronyms around, is working to create medical applications that use standard Windows component technology and new internet technology to plug and play with each other. Better information handling in medical organizations will be a requirement in the future. Some health organizations, recognizing that their patients' needs can't wait, are showing strong leadership. They're proving that a digital nervous system can make invaluable contributions in all areas of patient care, from emergency services through hospital treatment, patient follow-up, and long-term trend analysis. Web puts you in charge of your own health. I've personally spent many hours on the web reading information about health issues facing my friends and family. The degree of detail in medical information on the web is stunning. But there's lots of quackery out on the internet, too, so don't believe everything you find. Evaluate the credentials of the people or organization providing the information. Over time, the availability of so much data will profoundly improve the ability of people to get medical information and become more responsible for their own health decisions. Hamilton Jordan, President Carter's chief of staff, has battled cancer several times. When he was about to give up the first time, a friend told him, "Nobody has more at stake in your health care than you," and convinced Jordan to take charge of his case. For that first cancer, which he believes was caused by exposure to Agent Orange in the Vietnam War, Jordan used libraries for research. A decade later, fighting prostate cancer, he used the internet to become an expert on his illness and took an active role in treating it. Intel chairman Andy Grove had a similar experience when he faced prostate cancer several years ago. After going online to see what information was available about the various medical approaches, he quickly realized that there were no valid comparative studies. Ever the scientist, he wrote his own comparative study from the raw data. Jordan, with a family history of prostate cancer, chose surgery. Grove, with a different history and circumstance, chose a combination of general and smart bomb radiation therapy. The important thing is that with good medical advice and their own research, both men made informed decisions for themselves. The internet is about more than medical information, though. It enables patients who have the same malady to stay in touch, share their experiences, and feel less alone. The community of patients is worldwide, and online forums make it easy for them to connect. The Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle is experimenting with a new approach to creating an internet community. The center is using virtual reality to create a sense of being there for patients and their families. The virtual experience appears to be exceptionally valuable before a patient comes to the center, fostering a greater sense of comfort and familiarity. A patient and his family can visit the center over the Internet and do a three-dimensional virtual walkthrough of the facility. They can attend presentations on different topics and visit with other patients and their families in common areas. Later, a family member can make an appointment to have an online chat with a specific staff member he's come to know. These virtual experiences don't replace, but augment face-to-face personal contact. Providing instant reflexes in emergencies. More than 80 ambulance services and fire departments in 6 countries are achieving life-saving reflex capabilities with PC-based systems. Coupled with global positioning system, GPS, satellites, these systems locate the ambulance nearest a patient's home and map the fastest route to get there. The 2 largest nationwide emergency services companies in the United States, American Medical Response, AMR, and Rural Metro Ambulance Service, use PCs to recommend to dispatchers the best redeployment of remaining emergency vehicles once some vehicles have been dispatched. Rural Metro in San Diego can calculate how many of its 500 fire apparatus and which vehicle types need to get to a fire. A ladder truck might be required for a high-rise fire, for instance, or hazardous waste equipment might be needed for a factory fire. The Denver Fire Department uses a PC-based system to display the floor plans of major buildings and the locations of hydrants, and to alert firefighters to anybody with disabilities living close to a fire who might need to be evacuated. Perhaps no emergency services firm in the country has made more use of PC technology than Acadian Ambulance and Air Med Services in Lafayette, Louisiana, which is building a complete flow of information around Tri-Tech software systems, VisiCAD for fire EMS software. CAD here means computer-aided dispatch, not design. With 1,200 employees and $90 million in revenues, Acadian is the largest independent ambulance company in the United States. From a single dispatch center in Lafayette, Acadian serves 26 parishes, counties, across 17,000 square miles of cities, towns, sugarcane fields, rice fields, and bayous in the southern part of the state. On a typical day, Acadian will handle 500 to 600 calls involving ambulances and medical helicopters. Users of the PC-based emergency response software system say that it consistently cuts